Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Latitude Lecture Series, where the Alaska Design Forum is hosting architect Florian Maurer. Recorded at the Anchorage Museum on Monday, March 8th, KSKA presents Florian Maurer on Latitude Attitudes.
Welcome, everybody, tonight. My name is Klaus Meyer. I'm with the Alaska Design Forum, and it's my pleasure tonight to introduce you our guest speaker. Our guest tonight, Florian Maurer, was born in Germany and educated in Munich. He told me the first day after he graduated, he left Germany, was heading for America, and then made his way into Canada. He started practicing as an architect after some stories that he will share with us afterwards in Whitehorse. And so he's been very familiar with the cold climate issues. Nonetheless, he will actually talk more about latitude, attitude, so the certain attitudes that you have to develop in the north. Currently, he's not practicing in Whitehorse. He moved to Italy for a couple of years. And then now he's, what's this place called again?
Penticton.
That is interior of Canada on the west. And with that, I want to introduce Florian.
Thank you. Before I begin, I need to come clean with you. I picked up a copy of the Anchorage Press yesterday in which this lecture was advertised. And it said that design for remote communities with harsh climates was my specialty. But that was a long time ago. In 2000, I moved to Italy and practiced there for a while and then returned to Canada in 2004 to the very south, a place where there's orchards and vineyards. In fact, the title of your lecture series, Latitude, started to worry me a little bit. What can I tell an audience of Alaskans about a cold climate when I'm living among orchards and vineyards? Let me tell you, the last 30 hours or so here in Anchorage, I almost died of exposure. That's what a wimp I've become since I moved away from the Yukon. Also, the Scandinavian architects that you have met in this lecture series, they all practice in countries with long-standing traditions of cold climate design. In the 10 years I practiced in the Yukon, we barely started to seriously question the practice to parachute generic southern designs onto the north. And I'm not sure if it's the same in Alaska, but I suppose could be possibly similar. And unlike my Scandinavian colleagues, we had little local precedent and guidance to draw from, so we made mistakes. I'm also not an Aboriginal North American, so I don't want to lecture you on culturally significant northern building forms either. What I will do is talk about attitudes. They are universal. They apply wherever we might select to practice architecture. I will talk briefly about a cold climate and what I believe it means for our work. And then I will talk about things that really, really bug me. Greenwashing. The architecture of unhappiness, design guidelines, and fake. But don't worry, then I'll come to the attitudes that we really like to cultivate. They include optimism, generosity, happiness, and humor. And I will show you images of my work, and I would be tickled pink if you could detect elements of these attitudes in those images. But before I do so, let me introduce myself with a few frames here, so you know where I'm coming from. This is myself as a young immigrant 35 years ago. Unlike most of my colleagues who went straight from school to pursue a career as architects, I needed to find myself first. Here as a hippie homesteader in northwestern British Columbia, as a tourist guide, as a commercial fisherman just east of the Alaska boundary on the Stikine River, as a bush pilot. Now, don't you love that expression, that old New Agey expression, to find oneself? I just turned 61 and I haven't found a thing. I guess I give up looking. If you find something, let me know. I'm willing to learn. Now, this was my first piece of architecture as a young immigrant. Isn't it funny that a young architect, a German-trained architect, son of two architects, steeped in the tradition of the Bauhaus, could not escape the powerful stereotype of the log cabin in the bush? This is where we lived a number of years, and living here made me appreciate simple, common sense things that work. And with this attitude, I started my first firm in Whitehorse, and upon return from Italy in 2004 with my new partner, Chris Allen, in Penticton. Now, let me show you why moving from latitude to attitude is not so far-fetched after all. Look at these cold climates. There's the damp chill of the West Coast that goes right through your bone. There is the arid north with brutally cold, dark winters and hot, mosquito-filled summers. There is the North American East with sudden winter, crippling winter snowstorms followed by sudden thaws and muggy summers. And there is the fact that to somebody living in the tropics, any day colder than 22 degrees Celsius, I'm sorry, I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but it's pretty warm, will still feel cold. Every one of these situations requires a different design response, and we haven't even looked at cultural, historic, social, and other side factors yet. To me, to talk about design in a cold climate really means to make sense to talk about good design practices quite generally, and this is where the attitudes come in. The first attitude I like to cultivate is to recognize when they're selling us garbage. Green. You know, I'm getting tired of this word. I'm getting quite greened out. When you consider that you cannot buy a single thing anymore that doesn't claim in one form or another to be green, you wonder why we even have a problem. Why we even need a Copenhagen summit? We should be in ecological heaven. Listen to this. A Boeing 747 goes green, I read about 2 months ago on my Yahoo homepage. How so? It burns a small portion of biofuel. How big that portion is, we are not told. But what we do know is that it is being produced with farm machinery that burns diesel fuel that comes from the same ground than the jet fuel it replaces. And it ends up in the jet's tailpipe in exactly the same way as greenhouse gas and water vapor. This is called greenwashing, and its function is to make us feel good while things are not so good. Greenwashing diverts our attention from the big picture, where it ought to be, and to completely insignificant details, usually with somebody's intent to make money. We also like to cultivate common sense. Look at these three buildings and tell me which one is the greenest. Einstein said, we will not solve a problem using the thinking that has created it. And looking at the lead platinum bank high-rise on the right, it hits me squarely in the eye. We still think that growth is necessary for our happiness, but we also feel, we all know that there's limits to growth. The earth is only finite, and we all feel that we might have reached this point already. Still, we tinker with ways to prolong the agony because we are unwilling to truly question our way of life. Now, let me ask you, what good will all the lead buildings in the world do us if they still serve the same old unsustainable purposes? We might still end up in Orwell's 1984 with all buildings lead rated. I'm not asking you to live in igloos or herd goats in the mountains, but let's cultivate common sense. A simple thing like living within walking distance of your workplace in an old, small, inefficient house is 100 times more sustainable than driving 150 kilometers a day to and from your 3,000 square foot lead platinum condo in the suburbs in your Toyota Prius, even without faulty gas pedals, and buy carbon offsets for your trip to Vegas. It's costs a lot less, uses far fewer resources, and needs no new technology. Let's remember this next time we hear a claim for a particularly wonderful green wonder. What good does a car do us that gives us twice the gas mileage? If there's four times as many of them, and we drive twice the distance every day, we still burn four times the fuel. Let's explore the concept a little further by looking at one of the many green rating programs that are out there. The Build Green program has been developed by the Alberta and British Columbia Home Builders Association. The little house on the left-hand side gets no point for being small. It gets no point for not mowing down all the trees. It gets no point for having opening windows. And since it doesn't fulfill Build Green's base requirements for opening, for mechanical ventilation, it is not green. But you can mow down all the trees, build a monster house with fixed windows, as long as you have all the prescribed high-tech gizmos, and you even get an extra point for a PVC compost bin that every gardener will tell you doesn't work. And being made of PVC, of course, leaves its legacy of toxins in the ground forever and a day. Now, I will admit that lead has a lot more credibility, and it has served a good purpose by raising public awareness. But still, its efforts remind me of someone treating the sprained ankle of a patient who is overweight, alcoholic, chain-smoking, and headed for congestive heart failure. Of course, it's nice to treat his sprained ankles, but the guy has bigger problems. He should start changing his ways. The very term sustainability should tell us how disconnected we are from nature. McDonough and Baumgart say in their book Cradle to Cradle that a man who defines his relationship with his wife as sustainable must be a very unhappy man. That is us. Separate from nature, experiencing ourselves as nature's masters who have the right to take what they want, whenever they want, steer its affairs, make it sustainable for us. When things don't work out, we try to fix the symptoms, never the cause. I think it's our attitude that needs fixing. If we felt love instead of superiority for nature, we would realize that there is an abundance of resources out there to make us all happy. If we learned to take what nature gives freely and not constantly force our will upon it. Look at the sun. It sends huge amounts of energy into space every day, of which only the tiniest portion ever reaches the Earth, of which in turn we hardly use anything. Let's use it generously. Let's splurge it. Let's learn to use it. And an attitude of self-denial has never achieved anything good. An attitude of generosity and love always has. The next thing we'd like to do is recognize when our buildings don't deliver the goods. What do these buildings tell you? They tell me that their designers considered the North their enemy, that they must shut out at all cost. The left building is a school, and from the earliest childhood, the children are being shown disdain for their natural environment. And when they grow up, they find nothing wrong with dumping battery acid in a lake. It's their enemy, after all. An enemy against they can never win. Most of the children in this school are Aboriginal North Americans whose ancestors had a loving relationship for their land. That it takes 4 BTUs of natural gas to extract 1 BTU of crude oil from the Alberta tar sands is an environmental stupidity for which our grandchildren will curse us. But that's not the worst. This work camp north of Fort McMurray in Alberta showcases one of the principal causes of human suffering. It's called deferred happiness. To the man escaping unemployment and leaving his family in Newfoundland, this is just a temporary exile. He serves his happiness for later, when he will return with oodles of money. Later, later, never now. Later will, of course, never come, because by that time there is a new later. This is the principal condition of human suffering. In the meantime, he puts up being stored like a troglodyte and abused in a totally unwholesome process. When will we learn that in the meantime is the only time we ever have? That the end never justifies the means. Perceived and real emergencies often let us consider design responses that we would otherwise flatly refuse, and that in doing so, these design responses often become part of the emergency. I want to now show you an example of where we were confronted with a similar task and what we did to avoid this trap. Craiova is a city 200 kilometers west of Bucharest in Romania, and their dire emergency was also the working premise to bring relief to families that often lived sixfold in two small rooms like the one in the left-hand side, or even worse. The money of our client, a privately funded Swiss charity, needed to be stretched. We had no illusions about creating architectural masterpieces under those circumstances, but we still managed to let our respect for the human dignity of the occupants shine through in our work. We also pioneered North American style wood framing techniques on this project, and we trained our clients' own workforce in it. We did this to offer an alternative to the massive construction techniques that became largely unavailable with the collapse of communism. A carpenter needs a skill saw, a few hand tools, and a pickup truck to build a house. No precasting plants, no cranes, no heavy equipment. When you invest love, love gets returned. The occupants are now fixing festive awnings and planting shrubs and flowers. And I can tell you, after 4 years, this multi-residential development's general upkeep is in stark contrast to everything else I have seen in Romania. Another source of misery are design guidelines. They stem from an obsession to force a unified appearance to our buildings and towns. Most design guidelines also worship forms that have arisen at a different time, place, social, and economic reality, and the buildings that they create do not reflect our reality. These particular buildings photographed in Whistler, where we just had the Winter Olympics. Isn't it a sign of unhappiness if you consider your own time so inferior that you must retreat in a fictitious world of times past? Most design guidelines also have a very nebulous idea of the particular style that they want to emulate, and the result is a grotesque mishmash. It's called traditional architecture in Canada. I don't know what it's called in the United States, possibly similar. There's no tradition in any of this. Not like modern architecture, which hails back to the Bauhaus 80 years ago. The culture of fake is so ingrained in Western civilization that all architects at one point or another in their practice must confront it. I want to now show you an example where we had to grapple with powerful stereotypes and what we solutions we found. Dawson City in the Yukon is a national historic site, and all new construction must comply with very strict historic design guidelines. Now, the few remaining original buildings certainly are of great value, but that cannot be said about what is being produced under the guidelines. Now, to what extent the proponents of the historic design guidelines are willing to go, we became to feel when they were expecting us to design a new cultural center for the Trondekvechin First Nation in Klondike style. Of course, the Trondekvechin would not have any of this. To them, the Klondike Gold Rush was the most traumatic experience in their history. And after a controversy, they got their way. Still, we wanted to design a building that all inhabitants of Dawson could live with, not just the Trondekvechin. And the solution was to put the building on the dike overlooking the Yukon River and separated from historic Dawson by Front Street. This way, we created a dialogue of culture rather than a clash, and the building could sit overlooking their traditional giver of food and traveling route. It was far more difficult to fulfill our client's legitimate demand that their building showcase their traditions and culture. Also, the artifacts of a nomadic culture did not offer a direct cue for the design of a modern and permanent building. So we studied those artifacts, forgot them, and saw how they subconsciously found their way into the design. And this is the result, which I believe evokes the spirit of the Trondekvichin people without being literal or trite. The horizontal slats on the main building and the vertical slats on the rotunda were cut from locally milled rough sawn timber. Now let's talk about the architecture of happiness. We all know those that have everything and still don't manage to be happy, and those that can be happy in the middle of chaos. I believe when we are happy, our work shows us. In a happy society, engineers might design products that are beneficial for us in nature. Industry will produce them. Consumers will buy them, and architects will use them. I believe that the single most important ingredient of sustainable design is that our buildings make us happy. Buildings that don't make us happy are unsustainable. This is the belief we base our work on, and I want to now show you a few images how we try to be guided by this belief as best as we could. This is a long step back. In 1994, my wife and I bought this old public works house in Whitehorse and gave it a new life. We took the roof off and put on a full new story and a flat roof, and the result is Le Box, as the building is nicknamed still by the neighbors. On the south, a colorful rain screen gives life and depth to the facade and protects it against the strong prevailing southern winds and the strong southern sun. In the back, a funky little Romeo and Juliet balcony and a fire engine red steel column and a galvanized sheet metal shroud around the chimney let it fight with its own boxiness just a little bit, and here is this with Romeo and Juliet. In the front, the color scheme of rain screen and wall is reversed to give this domino effect. Now let's make a huge jump in time and place across the Atlantic and see how even an underground parking garage can benefit from an optimistic attitude and can bring a bit of happiness. Underground parking garages tend to be intimidating places. They tend to be the places where murder scenes for action movies tend to be filmed. We decided, therefore, to place sunken light wells at the end of each driving aisle and other important spots. This way, there's always a light at the end of the tunnel. There is good orientability, natural ventilation, and even interesting views from the pedestrian level. Now, 1 week after this parkade was opened, a lady wrote a letter to the local paper saying that this is the only underground parking garage where she, as a woman, feels safe. It's just a parking garage, but it brought a bit of happiness. Here is a view of one of those sunken light wells and how we screened the parking decks with these large slats. And meanwhile, this tree has a diameter of 2 feet almost. Things grow well in Italy. Here is a view from the bottom up to the triangular glass canopy. And even the surface stalls get special treatment. They are placed under these pergolas that are meanwhile overgrown with vines, and they not only create shade, but also give the surface parking lot spatial definition, which is normally sorely lacking, and make it a little more beautiful. Just a couple of kilometers down the road from the parking garage is this kindergarten and adult education building. And let's see how we try to make this a happier place. It sits in the northeast corner of a new multi-residential development, and the developer had to bring and pay for it and pay for it in order to be allowed higher density. This is something quite usual in Italy and quite successful. The strange building shape is a direct result of strict client requirements that all the group rooms have southern exposure, and yet we must maintain transparency from the northern access road through the transparent multipurpose rooms into the interior of the development. The left-hand cheesecake is the adult education center and the administration. Now, for us, it was the excuse to come up with a more fantastic building shape that we hoped might be more comfortable for the children. And these adventure balconies, we call them, that kids might just visualize being on the bow of a pirate ship with tackle, yard arms, and everything. Here is another one of those pointed components, the canopy over the entrance to the adult education facility. Now, that blue column that you see next to the peeled log column is not just a form of whimsy. It contains the rainwater leader. Here is another shot with the canopy and the adventure balcony and the play terrace for the upstairs rooms of the kindergarten. Each of the group rooms has its own stairway to its own upstairs room that is used for the kids taking a nap or motion therapy, and that has access to the play terrace outside. We used the space under the stairs to build these cubicles for the kids' belongings and their work projects. Now, an interesting fact about Italy is that the riser and tread ratio for kindergarten is something like 6 inches by 13 inches, if you believe it or not. That's why these are so extremely long, completely neglecting the fact that kids actually climb like apes. So, in the upstairs, lots of daylight and the beauty of wood were used to give these rooms a happier ambience. To the right, one of those group rooms with a large sliding door opening to the play terrace, and to the left, the office of the adult education center. Now, let me tell you the story of how working with and not against the beautiful site to build our house in Naramata upon our return from Italy, we gave ourselves the mandate to protect every single mature tree and leave the landforms and the beautiful bedrock ridge unaltered. And this was our first design. A sharp glass canopy turns into a skylight over the entrance, which in turn turns into a living room overhanging a steep drop-off to the west with a wonderful lake and mountain view. A kitchen and a studio to the south, two bedrooms, and a bathroom in the north, separated from the access road with this sunken patio and a single car garage. I have no doubt that this could have been developed into a very attractive building, but there was a nagging doubt that wouldn't go away. And here is why. As attractive as the building might have been, it would have still been just another repetition of the Northern European concept of the single building in the middle of a lot. That, I believe, comes from a culture where the oldest son always inherited the farm. This way, maintaining sizable land holdings where this concept would work. In small and urban lots, the side yards tend to become a repository for junk and toys. There is no protection from street noise, and the only views available, unless you are on a steep slope, are those that your neighbor puts in front of you. In southern European cultures, all the inheritance was divided among all, and they could not afford this luxury. So they adopted the Roman interior courtyard concept that creates twice the usable space in one-third the lot size, with perfect protection from street noise, a quiet, tranquil interior courtyard, and controlled views, looking at something that's of your own. This is the way we want it to go. And this is how it worked out. Here's the access road. A studio and single car garage form a breezeway through which you must walk in order to go to the main entrance door. We cannot see a car from our house. Once inside, you are in this private sheltered garden that is protected to the north by a garden structure that you will see later, and a covered loggia. To the west, in straddling the steep drop-off, to the west, the main house with the bedrock ridge diving right into the living room. And to the south, in a separate little building, our master bedroom. All existing trees were preserved and given an adequate root protection zone. Now, obviously, we had to conform with local bylaws in all the side yards, rear yards, and front yards. And so what you see could only be a very loose approximation of what a new way of thinking might achieve. Just imagine how sprawl could be reduced if municipalities could bring themselves to allow zero setbacks in residential zones. And just try it on a pilot project. You might like it. This axonometric view of the development compared to the original concept brings up an important point about architecture. Simplicity. As attractive as the original concept might have been, it would have owed its appeal largely to its interesting geometry and hopefully exquisite detailing, and you will agree that there might have been more than one difficult detail to resolve. By contrast, the courtyard concept is an array of simple boxes with shed roofs in repetitive detailing, and it is still, in our opinion, far better architecture. Garden structures. They are wonderful things. They are very inexpensive, and they achieve a great deal. This one here that shelters us from the north is a place where we grow scarlet runner beans during the summer that form a green wall within only 1.5 months. And to the north, we have this trellis made out of larch slats, and the cupboard place is an area where we can start seedlings in spring and store garden tools. And this is how we keep those large slats from twisting and buckling. We threaded them onto a half-inch galvanized electrical conduit, spaced them nicely with a crowbar, and then fixed them with self-tapping screws. The system worked so well that we are using it now for all kinds of garden structures in the neighborhood, like this pergola. I like this photo also because it makes a point about views. You know, most of my clients are very protective of their view, and they don't want anything between them and their view. And I tell them, look, every landscape painter has a foreground to give a scale to his view, and I think, yeah, I don't know what you feel about it. I like it. Another little project that brought us lots of joy is this little pavilion, a farmer's market pavilion in a small southern Okanagan town. The Farmer's Market Society had first approached a manufacturer of prefabricated metal structures, and after they received a quote that was twice of what they could afford, they came to us. They only remember architects when things go bad. And we found a way to cut their cost in half and also found them a builder who was also a wonderful artist. He cut this group of shoppers and produce out of 1-inch steel plate, washed them with acid, and let them rust. Looks quite nice. And on the last house I want to show you, we found a way to keep both our clients and the neighbors happy by obtaining a zero front yard relaxation. The site sits 5 meters below the street level, and by pulling it right against the property line, we could demonstrate to the authority that we are actually opening up more lake views for the neighbors across the street. The garage is in this tower, accessible on level ground quite shortly from the street, avoiding a long and steep driveway that is the curse for most houses in this neighborhood. We also needed to convince the authority here to allow us a multiple building concept, and we showed them with this original sketch how we would open up more lake views for the neighbors across the street. So what's my point? My point is that there are no ready-made recipes to make architecture regardless of the latitude. Every design has to arise from an intimacy with client requirements and site condition and particular climate that must be earned fresh every single time. My point is also that unless creating and using our buildings becomes an adventure that excites us and makes us happy, everything else becomes pointless, no matter how many rules we follow. To truly live, we must leave the comfort zone of reason. Let me show you how limited it is. If living as comfortably, economically, and sustainably as possible was the purpose of life, we should all kill ourselves the moment we are born. There would be no more pain, no more cost, and we would leave zero ecological footprint. The logic is unassailable. Still, most of us keep on living. Philosophers and religions have tried to come up with the meaning of life for a long time. Nobody has found an answer that reason can grasp because it is beyond reason, just like the value of architecture. It's about being connected with life and showing it in the way we build. Understanding technology, economy, sustainability make us good technocrats. But it's not enough to make architecture. So when that means throwing out all the rules, when it feels right to create buildings that grab us by the gut and are a testimony to the human spirit, so be it. Like Mies van der Rohe's Farnsworth House or Gaudí's Sagrada Familia. Even if their roofs leak, they have no privacy for their occupants, and they are impossible to heat, or cost a fortune, and take forever to build. Humanity would be a lot poorer without them. Let's keep that in mind next time the bean counters rip our design apart. Lastly, if you found my statements on greenwashing, the architecture of unhappiness, design guidelines in fake, too provocative, I apologize. I did not want to annoy you, nor do I think that these are the only possible positions. I wanted to purposely be emotional to stimulate a good discussion. Thank you.
You've been listening to architect Florian Maurer on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans. Recorded at the Anchorage Museum on Monday, March 8th, the Alaska Design Forum hosted Maurer's talk on Latitude Attitudes as part of their Latitude Lecture Series. Florian's talk was edited for broadcast on KSKA. If you would like to view his slideshow presentation, just visit our website at kska.org. Following his lecture, Florian Maurer responded to questions from audience members. First, he was asked, how do localities that have a desire to avoid boxes and boring design begin to approach creative and rational design in the face of common zoning and design standards?
You know, that's a tough one to answer, because I think to build our houses the way we want, even if they are the ugliest things on the face of the universe, is our birthright. I would personally stick up for the right of every, when we're talking about houses, right, single family houses, stick up for the right of every person to fulfill their own dreams. And I think speaking to an audience of Americans, I think this should probably resonate. Right? I don't know. I haven't seen design guidelines that work. The only design guidelines I've seen, and I've practiced architecture in two continents in many countries, they have never achieved anything good. I know they come possibly from a commendable motivation, but I don't like them.
Have you applied any solar panels to any of your own projects?
I did so at the second house I built while still a hippie homesteader in the bush. I didn't show you that building because it was looking too modern. And I had five solar voltaic panels there that was out in the bush. We had almost no road access, and I experimented with it. There's three kinds of solar. For solar voltaics to work, the authorities, the governments need to first get their head around net metering and subsidize selling power back to the grid, like they have done in Germany and in the Canadian province of Ontario. This way, stimulating the development and the commerce in solar panels. That's not happening in British Columbia. I don't know if it's happening in Alaska. And without it, solar voltaics are not moving forward. As far as solar hot water is concerned, it depends on the occupants on the building. There is if you are a family with three small kids and you have your washing machine running three times a day, solar hot water makes a lot of sense. For my wife and myself, where the washing machine runs once a week or even less, sorry to say this, it makes no sense at all. It is a completely negligible part of our energy household. And the third part, passive solar, that is the most fundamental in good architecture and design. And I think most of the, I didn't want to get into it, but most of the buildings I showed you had very precisely worked out passive solar strategies. Now, on solar voltaics, something interesting that just popped into my mind is in Germany and Austria, where they have net metering, and they have an abundance of solar and wind power during the day, they use this power to pump water back up into the reservoirs in the Alps, and at night they let it run back down through the turbines. It's a wonderful way to store this excess energy.
Do you have any clues about how to make solar panels and snow work together?
Well, I guess you have to brush the snow off. But there is another way of doing it. You see, there's two ways of positioning solar panels, and we've experimented with both of them. One way is to let it face perpendicular to the sun, and the other way is to have a reflective plane and have those panels almost vertical. And in this case, there would be no snow accumulation. That's worth a try.
Next, another audience member asked, can you please address the heating of multiple structures and the thermal loss as a result of the multiple windows, particularly in an Alaskan environment?
Well, thanks for asking this, because I was afraid that would come. Because obviously a house of 1,800 square feet that is in four buildings has not a very good ratio of building envelope and volume. But the fact is, I did an energy audit on my house, okay? And that was quite surprising, because in spite of the fact that we have 900 square feet of glass, which is, I must say, the only high-tech thing on this house. It's a state-of-the-art soft-coated low-E glass that filters out 65% of the infrared radiation. But still, our energy bills are lower than our neighbor's house that is the same size with one-tenth of the window area. And the total annual energy costs, and that includes hot water and cooking with gas, we're on natural gas, are $1,500. And one reason is that the inflow radiant heating is tremendously efficient, because when your feet are warm, you feel warm. And you don't have to constantly, like with forced air, keep the whole place warm, and most of it disappears through your roof. Then we have a big thermal mass there that equalizes the fluctuations. I don't know. It seems to work. But yes, I agree. It's not perfect, but I would rather have a small house that is nice than a big house with no windows.
Do you think the horizontal slats included in many of your garden designs have anything to do with your experience working and strategizing with solar panels?
The horizontal slats, I don't know. I think they started really as an ornamental attribute. And from the fact that we are avid gardeners, so we tended to make these structures that plants can climb on. They are not the most effective shading devices. So no, the slats really, I don't think they have anything to do with solar strategies.
What was your incentive for working with the municipality to improve views of the lake for the entire neighborhood?
Well, we had to, of course, go through a variance process, and I'm sure this is the same just about everywhere. And the variance process, like if the neighbors support what you are proposing, usually you get it granted. So what we did is we drew up various diagrams that showed how the views were affected by allowing us to pull the building as close to the property line as possible. I only showed you one, that was the site section, but also in plan, by pulling our building back, we opened up a larger view angle for the neighbors to the side. So the important thing is, if you can document something and you can prove that it's in the public interest, municipalities tend to then allow us. Well, you know, it may have been a win-win situation.
What was your win?
Our win was that we could let our driveway, that we could put the garage into the tower. And if we would have had to observe a 7.5 meter front yard, 7.5 meters, that are 25 feet, right? Then we would have had either tremendous civil work with retaining walls, and that would be prohibitive, or we would have ended up with a driveway down. About 18 feet down the drop. Right? And you can imagine at even a 13% grade how long that driveway would be. It would have gobbled up the best part of our site.
The last audience member asked, does your opinion on the limiting effect of design guidelines apply to residential and commercial buildings, or do you have different perspective on commercial buildings?
My comments on design guidelines strictly refer to aesthetics and not any other things like massing, building heights, because these are very valid regulatory tools that I absolutely subscribe to and that authorities should use properly. Strictly aesthetics, because I believe this is something that the public domain should not meddle with. That should be our freedom. I'll tell you a little story. In about 25 years ago, when I was visiting my folks in Munich, there was an architectural competition that comprised the rehabilitation of a large area in the medieval part of the city that had been destroyed in the Second World War. And I was, for the longest time, considering participating in this competition. And I had the idea I had was to go to the archives and dig out the historic property boundaries in the Middle Ages, 800 years ago. And as a contribution to the competition, say, let's reinstate those property boundaries and stipulate that nobody could own more than one lot, and then say you must build to the property line. There is a total exemption to off-street parking, and you must build four stories high. That's it. Nothing else. Right? No actual design. Just because I believe where we create our worst work as architects is when we try to artificially create heterogeneity. I see this everywhere. If we let heterogeneity arise by itself as an accident, as a result of humans expressing themselves, then good things happen, even if the individual buildings might not be so nice. When I immigrated to Canada in 1975, Robson Street in Vancouver was a really wonderful place. There was not a single building that had any architectural value. They were all developer specials, single two-story boxes, holes in the walls. But there was a vibrancy about it, the uses, the streetscape, that was compelling. Now, 35 years later, the Robson Street has been thoroughly gentrified. There is one fashion store after another and five Starbucks. And all the buildings want to be architectural marvels. You see what I mean? In the end, for an inner urban situation. It is not so much the quality of the original building. It's how they put together. That's it. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with architect Florian Maurer. He responded to questions from audience members following his talk on Latitude Attitudes, which was edited for broadcast on KSKA. You can view his slideshow presentation, which includes many examples of his work, on our website at kska.org. The Alaska Design Forum, who is an underwriter of KSKA, hosted Florian Maurer at the Anchorage Museum as part of their Latitude Lecture Series on Monday, March 8, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.